This is Taking Aim with
Rob Sherman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, February 11th, 2003. On February 5th, Secretary of State Colin Powell went before the United Nations to make a case for a U.S. assault against Iraq. He said, "We have sources who tell us that Saddam's regime has been experimenting on human beings to perfect its biological or chemical weapons. As for nuclear weapons," he said, "Saddam Hussein is determined to get his hands on a nuclear bomb. He is so determined he has made repeated covert attempts to acquire high-specification aluminum tubes. As for missile systems," he said, "there are missiles that Iraq wants in order to project power, to threaten and to deliver chemical, biological, and if we let them, nuclear warheads." And he said that instead of cooperating, Saddam Hussein and his regime are busy doing all they possibly can to ensure that inspectors succeed in finding absolutely nothing. Smoke and mirrors. It was all smoke and mirrors and just plain wrong. That is what Scott Ritter told the Associated Press on February 8th. Scott Ritter is a former UN weapons inspector after the Gulf War from 1994 to 1998. He said that Secretary of State Colin Powell, quote, did not provide any substantive evidence. In fact, smoke and mirrors. And this is what has been revealed by the Germans when they talked about Zarqawi, who Secretary of State Colin Powell said was the Al-Qaeda link with the Iraqis. And this is what has been coming out in throughout the press by one analyst after another. Today on Taking Aim, we are going to discuss in detail the Colin Powell critique before the United Nations, and also we're going to look at what the Democratic Party pundits from the Secretary of Defense Perry and what Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Shalikashvili had put in the Wall Street Journal about North Korea crossing the red line. Ralph?
It's called the Case of the Purloined Report. It could have come out of Sherlock Holmes. First casualties in the propaganda firefight, writes the Observer on Sunday, February 9th, in a devastating article in which it states that the so-called smoking gun boiled down to the plagiarizing of a 12-year-old U.S. graduate student's doctoral thesis. Grammatical errors and all. Late last Tuesday night, a three-page email started circulating among a select group of friends about the impact of sanctions on Iraq. Full of academic outrage, it exposed that the so-called secret spy dossier promoted by Colin Powell at the United Nations was cribbed from an American postgraduate's doctoral thesis, grammatical mistakes and all, based on out-of-date data 12 years prior. The article continues that there was not only the cobbling together of particulars out of a plagiarized doctoral thesis, but they changed the words where it suited them. You have both the British authorities and Colin Powell substituting terrorist for opposition, spying for monitoring, and altering the conclusions of this out-of-date report itself. It is a measure of the extent to which people are lied to and manipulated by this ruling class, and it was described by the Observer as little more than a fabrication and a citizen-paced job. Under the subheading, "The Large Lie," they wrote, "Working against the clock, with fairly thin material, insiders now admit that not only were corners cut, but the words were changed and their meaning exaggerated. The cut-and-paste job, and I'm quoting, was so incompetent that in combining these papers by Almarashi and Boyne, they confuse the various organizations. The case of the Pearline Report is but the little continuation of this process of lying to the peoples of the world, and the cut-and-paste job, the scissors-and-paste job, will remind our listeners of precisely what was done with the forged and fabricated tapes imputed to Osama bin Laden when they had Osama bin Laden greeting people to praise the destruction of the World Trade Center, when it was later disclosed that they scissors and pasted in a tape of Osama bin Laden at a wedding ceremony years before, when he was greeting the participants in the ceremony and celebrating that occasion. Scissors and paste, purloined reports, the big lie at work.
The report, it was called Iraq, its infrastructure of concealment, deception, and intimidation. In fact, when it was put up in January, the British said that it was prepared by Iraqi experts at the Foreign Office, or MI6. And as Ralph mentioned, they had a list of people who were from the intelligence services. Then on Monday, they had to repost the report on the web because they had to remove all those people connected to the intelligence service, because, as was revealed by Channel 4 in London, the report, in fact, was prepared by the Department of Communications in the Prime Minister's office. Iraq, its infrastructure of concealment, deception, and intimidation. The deception and the intimidation was prepared by number 10 Downing itself.
And the New York Times has to acknowledge in a headline on February 8th that the report, large sections of which were the basis for Colin Powell's own remarks before the United Nations, were not only, quote, lifted from magazines and academic journals years before, but the report itself was based upon distorted information fabrications. Again, this theme mirrored in the London Mirror, where the real authors of the Iraq dossier blast Blair and Powell is the headline in Daily Mirror. And again, in the British press, the Downing Street dossier plagiarized or scandalized the country. Channel 4 News exposed the extent to which the case before the United Nations was a tissue of lies. And here in the London Observer revealed the truth behind the U.S. poison factory claim, with an actual on-site reporter in the area in northern Iraq, which was described by Colin Powell as a center of Al-Qaeda's international network. And the Observer's reporter states, if Colin Powell were to visit the shabby compound at the foot of the large snow-covered mountain, he would be in for an unpleasant surprise. Described by the U.S. Secretary of State confidently as a compound run by a terrorist organization linked to Al-Qaeda, with terrorist chemicals and poisons factory, it emerges that it is little more than a dilapidated collection of concrete huts and outbuildings at the foot of a grassy sloping hill behind barbed wire and a courtyard strewn with broken rocks and debris, a few empty destroyed houses, a bakery, no sign of weapons anywhere, only the smell of vegetable ghee used for cooking. I discovered chopped up tomatoes and nothing else. The cook had left his equipment propped against a broken wall. And the article continues, how could chemicals or weapons of mass destruction be produced in this debris? And he exposes the entire scenario depicted so overwhelmingly by Powell as a tissue of lies from on the spot in the location, the reporter, the poison factory claim exposed, revealed the truth behind the claim of a poison factory by Luke Harding in The Observer on February 9th.
As Scott Ritter exposes, there's an old adage that if you repeat a lie a number of times, people then will accept it as true. And let's look at some of the lives that have been repeated over and over again. What Ritter exposed is that U.S. intelligence had provided information to weapons inspectors about the existence of mobile labs before Iraq stopped the original inspections in 1998. The inspectors went and looked at these vehicles, and they turned out to be innocuous labs, he said, used for testing food samples. But once again, before the United Nations, Secretary of State Colin Powell reiterates the information about these mobile labs. Then we, of course, have the aluminum tubes, which over and again, the Atomic Energy Commission has said that these cannot be used for the preparation of the nuclear program. Or anthrax. Powell asserted that Iraq was hiding large amounts of anthrax. As Scott Ritter said, U.S. military scientists concluded that whatever anthrax Iraq previously had, it was well past its 7-year shelf life and certainly not worthy of consideration. An important study was done at the University of Notre Dame. It's called Contested Case, Do the Facts Justify the Case for War in Iraq? It's by David Courtwright, Alistair Millar, George Lopez, and Linda Gerber, and it's available on the Internet. And they go through Powell's speech point by point. And as I said, they talk about the so-called food testing vans again. And they mention that once again, not just when Scott Ritter was there before 1998, but since the return of the inspectors to Iraq, the UNIVAC monitors have again conducted aerial observation and monitoring missions, and they have again found no evidence of any mobile laboratories.
Yes, Maya, those were the UNMOVIC monitors. UNIVAC is a big computer thing. No problem. UNMOVIC monitors demolished this entire fabrication. It was a very telling article based in part on the Notre Dame report by Jimmy Breslin in Newsday, and he said, and the title of it was, "They call this evidence." He said, Jimmy Breslin says, Powell was reduced to pointing to 18 trucks as the end of the world, and he showed that his case at the UN would have difficulty being heard in a criminal court on Queens Boulevard. He put his soul on the line for his masters, and it showed. He had 3 wiretap transcripts that were weak enough until I realized that the conversations were in Arabic, and I'd like to meet those translators before accepting this sleight of hand. They speak in Arabic. Powell doesn't translate. He points to conversations regarding a supposed UN inspector coming the next day, and the American translations reads, "Have we this modified vehicle? What do we say if someone sees the vehicle?" And Powell then remarks, "The general is incredulous." Now, how, Jimmy Breslin asks, does he know that? And then he continues to quote this presumptive conversation in Arabic. "You didn't get a modified one? Well, let's see, where can we get a truck? Did you evacuate things? We evacuated everything." No references to what they're talking about. Powell then says that 12 empty warheads on January 16th were revealed through a conversation between the two officers, but when the actual remarks of these presumptive officers are examined, they're not referring to anything that cites chemicals, that cites biological agents, and the Notre Dame report meticulously examines what in fact were found on the ground by these presumptive inspectors.
Now,
nothing.
As far as the so-called prohibited nuclear or nuclear-related activities, Dr. Mohammed El-Barade, who's the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, who had been conducting the inspections in Iraq, before the Security Council on January 27th had stated, quote, "No prohibited nuclear activities have been identified during these inspections." It doesn't matter what anyone says to Secretary of State Colin Powell has a case to make, and he is going to make that case no matter what the truth is.
There is a long history of deception and deceit because we have been so clearly establishing over a long period of time that they've been targeting Iraq since the 1970s with the Odinion report calling for its fragmentation, with the wolf of its plans for breaking Iraq into many components, for the design to invade Iraq and to overthrow its regime that have been on the drawing board, the order given by Rumsfeld immediately after September 11th without any reference to the presumptive relationship of Iraq to those events. It is a long-standing plan. It is a plan that is going to be put into play, and the abracadabra of fabricated evidence is but the little continuation of lying and deceiving the peoples of the world to sustain this imperial design.
You know, Ralph, they talk about inspections. There have been over 400 inspections throughout Iraq, and I noticed in an article of exactly where they're going. They talk about inspecting missile sites and so forth. Many of these sites that they call missile sites were destroyed during the first Gulf War. But it was revealed, for instance, that this week their inspections were at an elementary school and a dairy plant, a place producing milk for the Iraqi people. And the U.S. State Department and its own estimates of what Iraqi expenditures are noted that the Iraqi expenditures on military dropped from $22.5 billion in 1990 to an average of $1.2 billion per year in the late 1990s, and that there was only a trickle of any military goods that could have flowed into Iraq. Now, you compare this to the $380 billion U.S. arms industry budget, that's just the overt budget, and the intent of the administration to bring this up to $500 billion over the next number of years. And what are they talking about here?
Maya, the basic premise, which I have to say too many people in the anti-war movement are accepting as well, namely the supposed entitlement to inspect any other country in the world on U.S. demand. The entire role of the United Nations with respect to either sanctions or inspections buys into the imperial premise, and the entire ideological construct, which is designed to sustain the fiction that the U.S. Military and ruling class has the right to dictate to peoples of the world what their governments can do or cannot do. This entire question of weapons of mass destruction and biological agents monopolized by the United States, the biological and chemical agents of the regime of Saddam Hussein were supplied by the United States to Saddam Hussein for the purpose of the attack upon Iraq, as we have documented. And
the
been,
attack on Iran.
Excuse me, the attack on Iran. And to remind our leaders, readers of the article in the Glasgow Sunday Herald on the 15th of September of last year, Bush planned Iraq, quote, regime change before he became president. A secret blueprint for U.S. global domination reveals that President Bush and his cabinet planned a premeditated attack on Iraq to secure, quote, regime change before he took power, that's to say Bush, in January 2001. The blueprint uncovered by the Sunday Herald for the creation of a global Pax Americana was drawn up for Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and George W. Bush's younger brother Jeb and Louis Libby, Cheney's chief of staff. The document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, prepared in September 2000 by the neoconservative think tank Project for the New American Century. And the plan shows, as the Sunday Herald details, whether or not Saddam is in power, they intend the United States to take military control of the Gulf region and to seize the oil of that country. That is what this is about, as everybody understands. And indeed, this terribly devastated country, this country that was laid low by a bombing that exceeded in a matter of days in volume of devastating arsenal, the total tonnages dropped during the entirety of World War II. The enormity of this destruction has resulted in a country described in the Chicago Tribune on November 9th, Iraq, a crumbling and broken land, humanitarian crisis looming as war nears. Quote, though born in the decade since the Persian Gulf War ended, Shaha Abdullah's children suffer from the conflict's effects, as do most of her neighbors. This is about Mosul in Iraq. The sewage seeps into their school, bringing stench and disease. The tap water is contaminated. The lights go out during homework time. In physical decay since 1991, Iraq is in far worse shape than before the Gulf War. A massive humanitarian crisis looms, stated the high-ranking United Nations official who developed plans for Baghdad to cope. 6 million people in Baghdad alone will be without water, power, and food. In 1991, the United States incapacitated 20 of the nation's generating plants, leaving it 4% of its generating capacity. The United States is planning to bomb all of the water distribution facilities, the sewage facilities, the electrical utilities, stated the supervisor of the United Nations Development Program in Baghdad. Everything here will be destroyed. Everything present is obsolete and outdated. Iraq's electricity grid will be eliminated. The generators are already futile. They have run out of fuel. The country will be out of water. The water and sewage systems are already in deep decay. 40% of Iraq today has no access to clean drinking water. Two-thirds of its sewage treatment facilities are inoperable because the sanctions prevent any supplies from being brought in to renew them. 500,000 tons of raw sewage are dumped into the Tigris and Euphrates rivers every day, poisoning the villages across the country that depend upon it. Day after day, it gets worse, says Karima Hamid, who does not keep rugs on her floor because the water and sewage seep through the foundation of her apartment. Over 2 million people living in squalor in Saddam City. The report goes on, it is a sickening nightmare of a devastated society already destroyed and now to be subjected to yet another genocidal attack. While Powell prates before the United Nations of the threat that this destroyed country presents to peoples of the world, lies and deceit.
Yes, Ralph, and it will create, through the occupation of Iraq, a long-term occupation of Iraq, much income for Brown and Root, Halliburton Company, the company of which Dick Cheney, our vice president, was the CEO. As DEPCA reports, Turkey, Jordan are back on track, and that's because Turkey is planned to be the launching pad for the U.S. invasion force that would be stationed in Turkey and then come through the north of Iraq to occupy. And Jordan is essential too because the U.S. troops. Not only would Jordanian airspace be necessary for the bombing of Baghdad, bombing which it would be essential to complement the 3,000 cruise missiles to lay Baghdad low, to do just what you were saying about destroying the water, the electricity, and so forth, but that they expect troops, U.S. troops, to come through Jordan and to occupy the western section of Iraq. Now, to come through the north is critical for the United States because they want to take over right away the oil fields of Kirkuk and Mosul. And then what we would have as DEPCA, the Israeli intelligence journal that's online, as DEPCA reports, the U.S. has planned to maintain 70,000 troops. Now, remember, this would be if it's the same as the cost to maintain the so-called peace troops. That's the occupying army in ex-Yugoslavia. It's $200,000 per troop, per U.S. troop. So that's 70,000 U.S. troops, which would protect the oil fields, and then under the command of Tommy Franks, the head of the Central Command, the U.S. would be occupying Iraq not for a year and a half, as the U.S. says, but long standing, and the U.S. would immediately focus not on the production and the humanitarian conditions in Iraq, but on increasing oil output, which has been reduced to 1.6 million barrels a day through the devastation and of both the Gulf War and the sanctions, to increase it to 6.5 million barrels a day.
Maya, the Sunday Herald in Glasgow on September 22nd of last year ran a very important article called Unveiled, The Thugs That Bush Wants in Place of Saddam. And it begins by saying, corrupt, feckless, and downright dangerous, they make the butcher of Baghdad himself look good. Now, the butcher of Baghdad, as they describe Saddam Hussein, of course, was our man in Baghdad, the ruling class man in Baghdad for 27 years, a CIA asset who was used to murder Abdul Karim Qasim in the counter-revolutionary CIA putsch in 1963, installed by the United States, sustained by the United States, the vehicle for destroying the national movement and the anti-colonial movement in Iraq. Who are the people that the U.S. creation in Baghdad, Saddam Hussein, will be supplanted by? General Nizar al-Khazraji, the field commander who led the 48-hour chemical weapons attack on Kurdish villages. Now, of course, the United States has imputed to the Iraqi regime the use of cyanide gas, which in fact, it turns out, as Stephen Pelletier of the Defense Intelligence Agency has documented, was the crime visited upon the population of Halabja by the by Iranian forces. But notwithstanding that, it was Nizar al-Khazraji who was presiding over the assault upon the Kurds by the regime of Saddam Hussein. Interestingly enough, Ambassador David Mack, the senior official in the U.S. State Department, who coordinates the Iraqi opposition for the Central Intelligence Agency and for Bush, described Nizar al-Khazraji as the man with the right ingredients to be the future leader in Iraq under Tommy Franks. A Danish newspaper investigating al-Khazraji's role found that he was the field commander who used chemicals and biological agents supplied by the United States in areas across Iraq where there was opposition to the regime.
Ralph, another choice would be Brigadier General Najib al-Salehi. And who is he? He was the commander of the armored division of Iraq's elite Republican Guard in the Gulf War. Now, when there was an uprising that was inspired by the CIA in Iraq, it was the job of Salehi to put it down. And Salehi was so enthralled by the crushing of the uprising that he wrote a book called El Zilzal, The Earthquake.
Actually, Maya, what's interesting about this is that the Shiite uprising in the south of Iraq was, in fact, the base of the national regime, along with the working class in the oil-producing centers of Iraq, that sustained the nationalization of Iraqi oil and the reduction of Western imperial control to 0.1% of the territory of Iraq under Abdul Karim Qasim, that led the CIA to install Arif and Saddam Hussein in power in the first place. And now comes Najib al-Salehi. Not only was he the figure who repressed the Shiite uprising, the CIA inspired it or encouraged it and then betrayed and abandoned it because they want to destabilize Saddam Hussein, but they don't want to permit Shiite self-determination. And this figure, who was the in charge of the Republican Guard, al-Salehi, carried out an all-out slaughter of the Shiite uprising, and he is the point man now for the United States, along with al-Khazraji, to control Iraq under U.S. direction. So much for their presumptive concern about tyranny in Iraq. It's all about the subjugation of the populace by whatever means necessary and the direct control of the resources of the country by U.S. imperialism itself.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today is Smoke and Mirrors. You are listening to us on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and on the internet at www.wbai.org. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or write to us at Taking Aim at PacBell, PACBELL.net or at our post office box 6345 Vallejo, that's V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. Our Taking Aim programs are now archived on the internet at www.radio4houston, and that's the numeral 4, radio4houston.org/taking aim. Now we're coming up to the WBAI Fund Drive. It starts very soon, and next week we will have a special Taking Aim program. We are going to go on the air at 3 o'clock instead of our normal 5 o'clock. So if you have the opportunity, tune in at 3 o'clock and we'll have a special 3-hour Taking Aim broadcast next week. So now to return to Smoke and Mirrors, because after all, Colin Powell said he was making a case for an assault on Iraq. And what we've shown is this is, once again, lie upon lie. And that the real intent for Iraq is to occupy, control the oil of Iraq and to prevent the self-determination of the Iraqi people. We've mentioned two of the generals that could be put in place eventually through the process of pacification of Iraq, but also on the drawing board is Ahmed al-Shalabi, who, as everyone knows, was the head of the Iraqi National Congress, which was the umbrella organization created in 1992 with the assistance of the CIA. Now, he has a checkered past, too. He had set up in Jordan, where he was in exile, the Petra Bank. And what he did was they stole the money from the Petra Bank, leading to a collapse, and the customers lost their savings, lost the money that they had in the bank. He was tried in absentia in 1992 because he fled from Jordan to London, and he was sentenced to 32 years in prison.
Well, he is a man after Bush's heart, after all. This is exactly the way in which Bush made his money out of Harkin Energy and Jeb Bush as well. These people loot the banks, they loot the public, and then they place themselves in political office. Shalabi is cut from the same cloth. The ruling class is a gang of thugs that has the color of authority through their seizure and of state power through the financing of the entire political apparatus. In November 10th of 2002, the Toronto Sun disclosed, after Iraq, Bush will attack his real target, and the real target, the next target, is Iran. And the details in this article are stunning. It's instructive to see as well that they are coordinated with the Mossad and with the Israeli armed forces. The prevailing view in the Israeli military is that Iraq will be split into three cantons and that the next target will be Iran, with 68 million people and a growing industrial base and a huge oil supply. It has been targeted as the next a country to be assaulted by both the United States. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has already announced that he is calling for an invasion of Iran, as the article states, the day after Iraq is crushed. Pentagon hardliners have already drawn up the plans to invade Iran once Iraq and its oil are secured. They are promoting, quote, civil war in Iran, riven by hostile factions, after an invasion then by the United States will install a U.S.-directed regime in power. And furthermore, the Pentagon super hawk, as the Toronto Sun describes him, Richard Pearl, has prepared a report which will lead for an American assault not only on Iran, but then an attack on Syria and an occupation of Lebanon. The Toronto Sun details the plans for permanent war with which the American people are going to be besieged, with pretexts, with terror alerts, with repression, with the panoply of techniques deployed by a ruthless and relentless ruling class hell-bent upon permanent military occupation of countries ad seriatim.
I'm surprised they didn't mention Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis themselves believe that the U.S. has designs on Saudi Arabia, and that is why they announced that after the completion of the attack on Iraq, they want U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia.
And all military installations removed. Well, of course, Maya, with the Oded Yunon plan, which was echoed by Wolfowitz and Pearl in the plans that they elaborated in the Committee on the Present Danger, each Arab nation, each Middle Eastern nation is to be fragmented in its turn and to be the target of direct military occupation by U.S. imperialism. It doesn't stop there. From Iraq and Iran and Syria to Korea, the beat continues.
The beat for permanent war. Now, it's interesting, Ralph, you mentioned Korea, because on February 6th, it was very telling, the opinion and editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. On the left-hand side, you had the Wall Street Journal editorial about assaulting Iraq. And then on the right-hand side of that page, you had William J. Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense under the Clinton administration, Ashton B. Carter, who was the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and John M. Shalikashvili, who was the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff under the Clinton administration. And their commentary was a scary thought: loose nukes in North Korea. So you had the left-hand side of the page of the Wall Street Journal calling for an attack on Iraq, and you had the right-hand side of the page from the Clinton administration calling for an attack on North Korea. Because what they were saying, quote, while the world prepares to disarm Iraq of chemical and biological arms by force if necessary, it does nothing as a potentially larger disaster unfolds in North Korea. Dot, dot, dot. Loose nukes. Loose nukes. That's what they're talking about. They're saying that what's going on in North Korea is crossing the red line. Quote, we cannot wait for the Iraq situation to resolve itself while the North Korean government is taking actions that cross a dangerous red line. Red line, they say it's an unacceptable threat to our security and to the security of the region. What are they talking about?
Maya, you're talking about the possibility of North Korea with its nuclear reactor eventually being capable of producing 5 Hiroshima-sized nuclear bombs, about the explosive power that they put into the warheads of a couple of cruise missiles with their depleted uranium in the United States. But more to the fundamental point, Richard Halloran of the New York Times, the military correspondent of the New York Times, disclosed in 1998 that the United States had already prepared for the invasion and occupation of North Korea. The document that was in November 1998, the former military correspondent for the New York Times, who is now the director of the Center for War, Peace, and News Media, he published a detailed account The United States had targeted all of the centers of government administration and their facilities in Korea. A senior United States official told Halloran at the time, "When we're done, they will not be able to mount any kind of resistance. We will kill them all." The secret designs on North Korea have been elaborated since not only 1998, but prior. And indeed, the object of this exercise is not just to provide an encirclement of China, because the detailed reports that Halloran uncovered included a design to prepare a confrontational, as he calls it, a confrontational policy against Beijing, which they consider to be a country with the potential to develop its vast resources and provide an opposition and resistance to U.S. dominance. And consequently, their objective is to fragment China. All of the hoopla about this tiny and impoverished country, North Korea, is about that. The U.S. war plan to invade North Korea that Halloran detailed on November 14, 1998, is based upon an operational and strategic plan which they have been putting into place. But what is interesting as well is that we find that they are describing not only operational plans for North Korea, but control over 40 billion barrels of oil reserves in the Western Sea of North Korea. Description of this in a website that not only got hold of the military report described by Halloran, it's www.koreanp.co, but it has the particulars about American designs upon an estimated reserve of 40 billion barrels in the offshore oil fields in the Western Sea. This was again documented in a South Korea monthly magazine. So it is again resources and oil, the resources of impoverished peoples that American imperialism covets and creates pretexts for the opportunity to seize.
Ralph, the Canadian-based Cantech, K-A-N-T-E-K, company had declassified a report on September 25th that the North Korean oil reserves in District 606 of the Korean West Sea Continental Shelf could be 40 billion barrels. And in fact, the Canadians have been working with the Korean government to do oil exploration there, because this would mean that Korea, which is in a devastated country, a country devastated during the 1990s by famine because of floods and also a lack of production, an estimated 3 million people died during the famine in the 1990s, that this would be an opportunity for Korea to have some energy self-sufficiency.
Well, actually, you see, what is also at hand is that the real intent here and the demonization of North Korea with its attempts to develop some minimal ability to defend itself against already announced and openly declared American intention to invade them, they ignore the fact that the Clinton administration had negotiated with the Koreans to shut down these nuclear reactor plants, which were largely involved in trying to supply electrical power and energy to the country to sustain its meager ability to feed its population. And the Clinton administration had committed itself to provide electric power as an alternative source of electrical power for the country, and all of this has been reneged upon. They reneged upon it. They have blockaded the country, and now when the regime attempts to put into play the facilities that could now could allow it to regain the electrical power that it was deprived, that is cited as the casus belli to justify plans lines that already had been in play 2 decades ago.
In the Los Angeles Times on Tuesday, February 4th, they noted that inflation adds another woe for North Korea, that annual price rises are at 600%, so that even those people who have work cannot afford to buy enough life-sustaining rice to support their families. And what caused this inflation is that the North Koreans were putting in what they call price and wage reforms. In other words, they were implementing a market economy. They were catering to capitalism.
Well, Maya, the New York Times on the 29th of December disclosed U.S. Ready's plan previously prepared to raise pressure on North Korea. And in this article, it discloses that the Clinton administration had plans for preemptive military strike on North Korea in place years before. And then Clinton's regime promised a multinational effort to ship fuel oil to Korea and to build light water reactors to supply them with electricity. And that plan was then, or that commitment was then, reneged upon. Again, as I had mentioned just before, they set them up and they created the conditions in which the Koreans, understanding full well what the U.S. Military intent is with respect to that country, are now being put forward as the as a menace, when the menace is transparently the vast power of American imperialism, which has targeted North Korea for many years.
Permanent war from one point of the globe to another. While the U.S. has troops based in over 100 countries and is amassing within the Middle East forces of 150,000 troops minimum, and has plans to increase the troop base in the surrounding Korea. So what is happening here at home and throughout the world? In Great Britain, they're anticipating a march of 1 million people, 1 million people in Hyde Park and in New York and in San Francisco and in cities throughout the United States. There have been nonstop anti-war demonstrations. So what we see again on this page, this remarkable page of the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, February 6th, where I pointed out that on the left-hand side of that page, you have the Wall Street Journal beating the drums for war in Iraq, and on the right-hand side, you have the former Clinton administration officials beating the drums for war against Korea. You have in the center of the page an article by Elliot A. Cohn, the reluctant warrior, about Secretary of State Powell's speech. But in it, he talks about something else, which is our opposition. He says, there is something out there, something deeper, uglier, and far less rational, an artesian river of hatred that has seeped in pools to the surface. And he talks against the critiques of war, the people who expose what is happening. And what he calls us is a subterranean stream that will continue to flow. And what is his solution? He said the problem before the administration is, quote, how to dam, divert, or dry it up. Dam, divert, and dry it up? Well, if you look at what is taking place behind the scenes in secret, they are setting the stage for deepening the oppression in the United States with Patriot Act number 2.
But before we deal with the Patriot Act number 2, which is a secret document, it was concealed from members of Congress, it was concealed from the Justice Department itself. What is behind the latest orange alert? Asks the Newsweek of February 7th, Michael Isikoff and Daniel Kleidman. And there is a remarkable documented disclosure here. New intelligence reports point to multiple imminent attacks against Jewish groups and Jewish-owned businesses throughout the United States by Al-Qaeda. Newsweek states that the Bush administration raised the national threat alert from yellow to orange based upon its intelligence reports of multiple imminent attacks by Al-Qaeda against Jewish groups and Jewish organizations across this country. And we learned from the article in Newsweek that this entire scenario has been coordinated with Abraham Foxman, the national director of the Anti-Defamation League, which is described by Newsweek as one of the country's leading Jewish civil rights groups. In fact, the ADL is an intelligence operation in coordination with the FBI, the Mossad, and the Central Intelligence Agency, which has maintained files on opposition to American policies over a period of decades and has faced lawsuits across the country from people who have been subjected to its spying for the intelligence apparatus. But more to the specific point, the article in Newsweek tells us that the Orange Alert, the terrible threat of an imminent terrorist attack, is based upon monitoring of Al-Qaeda operatives throughout the United States. Al-Qaeda operatives throughout the United States whose communications are being monitored by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and whose plans to attack Jewish businesses and Jewish houses and Jewish community centers and Jewish hospitals and Jewish youth groups and Jewish hotels and Jewish resorts have been monitored and overheard. How interesting. They don't arrest these people whose activities they so easily monitor from day to day. They don't identify them. They don't disclose where they are in the United States since they're able to monitor their communications. But what's particularly instructive here is that by announcing that the Orange Alert is based upon attacks upon Jewish institutions, they prepare for the charge of anti-Semitism to be leveled against any of those who oppose U.S. policy. Because this presumptive targeting of Jewish centers is a preparation for the demonization of all who oppose U.S. policy and who will then be targeted as presumptive apologists for attacks upon Jewish institutions. You can see it coming, brothers and sisters. It's been the pattern of the past. It is the project of the near future.
In fact, Ralph, that is the conclusion of Elliot Cohn in his opinion piece, The Reluctant Warrior, where I told you he's talking about how to dam, divert, or dry it up. He said that anyone who opposes the U.S. policy of the neoconservative hawks is really engaged in anti-Semitism. Now, we really must mention the Patriot Act, too, and you can actually read the draft of the secret document at publicintegrity.org. It may be difficult to download, but do try it, because one of the elements of it is that when, as you know, the government establishes a list of terrorist organizations, what so-called terrorist organizations, without giving any rationale of why one organization or another is put on that list. But part of Patriot 2 would be to deprive U.S. citizens of their citizenship if in any way the government claims that there is an association between a U.S. citizen and one of these so-called terrorist organizations.
Yes, Maya. In Section 101, Section 102, we're going to do a special program on this Patriot Act, too, because it's an 87-page document which we've obtained, but it is extraordinary what they are preparing to do. They're going to designate individuals who oppose U.S. governmental policy as agents of foreign powers, and they're going to reserve to themselves the authorities to take away our citizenship if we oppose policies of the U.S. government, to declare us as non-citizens, and to declare us as instruments of foreign terrorist control if we oppose U.S. policy. And the basis for this will not require any evidentiary hearing. There will be no right to any trial or to lawyers or to any of the due process that people are expected to be their constitutional right in this society. This Patriot Act 2 is a preparation to round up people, to deprive them of their citizenship, to deny them their civil liberties on the basis of nothing more than their opposition to U.S. policy itself. And indeed, in the Sun, in the New York Sun, on February 7th, there is a very instructive article that illuminates what the Orange Alert is about as it does prepare for the implementation of Patriot Act 2. In its editorial on February 7th, the editors of the New York Sun called for New York City to obstruct the protest against a potential war in Iraq as long as possible, but also to monitor the organizers and the protesters for, quote, an eventual treason prosecution. And the New York Sun praises Police Commissioner Kelly and Mayor Bloomberg for preparing for this, for the designation of anti-war demonstrators and their organizers as traitors and as qualifying for a legal charge of treason. The editorial is specific in its demand in New York Sun.
No matter what they write, Ralph, we are the many and they are the few. So all out this weekend for our demonstrations, the 15th in New York City, the 16th here in San Francisco, and throughout the world, listeners, in your cities throughout the world.
Because our mobilization will expose their attempts to introduce the elements and the accoutrements of fascism in this society as they designate the people of the United States as traitors to a ruling class that is increasingly desperate, increasingly isolated, increasingly brutal, and increasingly exposed. Let us mobilize, let us build that movement, let us prepare for the removal of these people from power so that war and exploitation and misery and poverty are not the lot of humanity in perpetuity.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. If you'd like a copy of our program, contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net or write to us at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. You can also contact us at 212-209-2953, and our programs are now archived at www.radioforhouston.org/takingaim. Remember, next week we have a very special program. We'll be on for 3 hours, so tune in at 3 o'clock during the WBAI Fun Drive. We'll be with you next week for our special 3-hour version of Taking Aim.
The city of New York has imposed an outright ban on one of the most important forms of protest, and that's the right to speak with your feet, the right to march.
While a federal judge has denied the right for anti-war protesters to march to the United Nations on February 15th, organizers for the United for Peace and Justice Coalition vowed to continue to demonstrate against the war on that day. The rally will begin to assemble at 11 a.m. on Saturday at 49th Street and 1st Avenue. For those listeners marching under the WBAI banner, rally at 52nd Street and 2nd Avenue at 10 a.m. Again, people will begin to assemble on Saturday, February 15th at 11 a.m. on 49th Street and 1st Avenue, while WBAI listeners will assemble at 10 a.m. on 52nd Street and 2nd Avenue. For more information, call 212-209-2815. That's 212-209-2815. See you at the rally.
This is a test of the emergency alert system. This is only a test. test of the emergency alert system. The broadcasters of your area, in conjunction with federal, state, and local authorities, have developed this system to keep you informed in the event of an actual emergency. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
WBAI, New York, the People's Radio Station for Peace and Justice, 99.5 FM. WBAI is a community radio station, a commercial-free radio station. Very important here, this is a listener-supported radio station in the center of the FM dial. We begin our winter fundraising drive tomorrow at 6 a.m. Please do join us. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio guide throughout the afternoon into the early part of the evening. The WBAI News is upcoming in just a moment.